Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking to the author of We Too Sing America, South Asian, Arab, Muslim, and Sikh Immigrants Shape Our Multiracial Future. The book is published by The New Press. The author is Deepa Iyer. I hope that you enjoy the interview that I did with Deepa today. Welcome back to the podcast. Again, my name is Heath Brown, and I have the pleasure today to have on the line Deepa Iyer, who is the author of We Too Sing America, South Asian, Arab, Muslim, and Sikh Immigrants Shape Our Multiracial Future. Deepa Iyer, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's such a pleasure to have read the book. As we've talked about earlier, this is a subject matter that I think a lot about and have had a real pleasure in reading your take. Before we get to your interesting new book, why don't you tell us just a little bit about where you are now and where you've been in the past?
Sure. So I am a senior fellow currently at the Center for Social Inclusion, which is a national nonprofit organization that strives to eliminate structural racism in institutions and different arenas in our nation. And previously, for about 10 years, I ran an organization called SALT, South Asian Americans Leading Together, which is also a national nonprofit that was shaped in the weeks and months after the 9/11 attacks to address issues affecting South Asians living in the United States. And much of that experience really has been formative in terms of the writing of the book that we are talking about today.
Yeah, and your background is just so very interesting and so related to your approach that you take here. You are an attorney by training, and you were at the Department of Justice in 2001. How did that year change the nature of the civil rights work that you did? Because you were deeply into these issues before September 11th. What was your work like prior to September?
Prior to 2001, as you mentioned, I was a new lawyer. I was working at a different nonprofit organizations in D.C. that focus on Asian American communities around language rights and voting rights and the like. And in the Department of Justice, I was specifically working at the Civil Rights Division, litigating employment discrimination cases for the most part. And I must say that, you know, it was really a watershed moment for me. And I think so many other people who came of age when 9/11 occurred. And for me in particular, after really grappling with the confusion and the horror of what had occurred on that morning, on that Tuesday morning, there began, as I say in my book, a sort of double grieving as we heard instances of profiling and harassment and assaults and later on murders of people who belong to the communities that I felt connected to and that I am part of. And so the civil rights work shifted quite a bit because it became really about a community that was immediately thrown into crisis, less about building and empowering and, you know, sort of the slow build of a civil rights understanding of what these communities were facing, but more after 9/11, a crisis approach, a reactionary approach due to the narratives and the policies and the actions that began to take shape and take place in the United States.
Now you worked on cases that were in many ways quite similar to the crimes that were committed in Wisconsin in 2012. For those that don't know what happened there, I wonder if you could briefly describe what exactly happened at the Sikh temple in Wisconsin.
Sure. You know, I think just as a preface to that, a lot of people, I think, are familiar with the fact that there was a backlash against South Asian, Arab, Muslim, Sikh, Hindu, immigrant communities and others after 9/11. But I think a lot of people believe that that backlash was actually frozen in time, that it was limited in time to perhaps the first year after the attack. And what I think that the attack at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin shows us is that that's not true. That particular tragedy occurred in 2012, in August of 2012. And basically what occurred was that a white supremacist barged into this Gurdwara, which is a place of worship in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, a couple of miles outside of Milwaukee, and terrorized the congregants who had been worshiping there that morning, Sunday morning. And in the course of the attack that he perpetrated, 6 people were killed and several others were wounded. One person still remains in a coma. And so that particular tragedy, which happened in 2012, reminded all of us in the community, and I think the nation, that these forms of hate violence are not actually going away, that they continue to exist in America, and that there is a targeting in particular of South Asian Muslims, Arab, and Sikh communities.
Yeah, and much of your book is about the commonalities between these communities, but maybe you can just describe a little bit more about who the subject is of this work. And in doing so, I wonder maybe if you could just talk about the cover of the book. This is one of the great covers, and I've had more people comment and inquire on the subways in New York about the book, and I think it's because of the cover. So maybe you could just describe the cover and also just tell us maybe who designed the cover. We should give credit where credit is due. And as a way just to talk about the diversity of the varied communities that you're focused on in the book.
Right. So the book itself is focused on South Asian, Arab, Muslim, and Sikh immigrants. And I focus on those communities in particular because I have more of a relationship and understanding of those communities given my own work. And while it is a work of nonfiction, it's not, you know, a memoir, it's not necessarily about me, but the book is a book that really combines a lot of storytelling coming from community voices with policy recommendations and some data points. And so that's why I chose those communities. And you're absolutely right. They are not necessarily one category, right? Although I would argue, and I argue this in the book, that after 9/11, these communities actually began to be seen and perceived as one. So, for example, the attacks, the backlash that we often see are really targeted against Muslims, but anyone who is perceived to be Muslim. So that could be someone who's Sikh, that could be someone who is a brown person from Pakistan, right? So it really is sort of this entire community got racialized after 9/11. In terms of the cover of the book, thank you for pointing that out. And I agree with you. I also have been getting a lot of really positive feedback from the cover of the book. And I think it's because it portrays the faces of people that represent the real diversity of America. In particular, the communities that I'm talking about in the book. But I've noticed when people look at the book, especially young people, will often say, oh, that looks like me, or that looks like someone that I know, or that's my cousin, right? So I think there's some sense of connectedness that people feel when they look at the book. And I think book cover, which was designed by the New Press, my publisher, and I think it also speaks to sort of the multiracial future, the inclusive democracy that the book also touches upon quite a bit, how our country is transforming dramatically when it comes to demographics. And so the book cover speaks to that as well.
It's a great cover, and I think it really does sell the book very well. Now, just to sort of get back to some of the content here, and the type of animosity that you describe in Wisconsin, it happens in lots of different communities, and sometimes it's not quite so violent. You know, sometimes it just fits into the day-to-day politics of a community. And in the interest of that, you write about the situation in Tennessee. I wonder if you would tell us a little bit about the organizing in opposition to immigrants, especially Muslim immigrants in Tennessee, and also the response to that anti-immigrant organizing in Tennessee and elsewhere.
Right. So, you know, in the book, I talk about how there are a couple of different trends that we can look at when we look at post 9/11 backlash. One is these forms of hate violence that we just talked about that happen in Wisconsin, or acts of discrimination at the workplace, or bullying of children in schools. And then a second piece is more organized activity. And that is something that I focused on in terms of what happened in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. I'll talk about that in just a second. And the third is policies, government policies, and political rhetoric. So all of those three trends kind of have come together to create a climate of fear and suspicion in post 9/11 America. But in particular, in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, I wanted to focus on that community because it's a very, you know, small community, about a half an hour outside of Nashville, Tennessee. And Nashville and the entire state of Tennessee is also really undergrowing that dramatic demographic shift that I mentioned earlier, where you have immigrant and refugee communities really settling in Nashville and other parts of Tennessee. And in Murfreesboro, the Muslim community there wanted to build a mosque, which is something that, you know, many communities, faith communities do around the country. And they immediately started to face some virulent opposition that, you know, included acts of vandalism to the property itself, that also included a large number of people, mainly white residents of Murfreesboro, coming to a city commission hearing and, quote, testifying, unquote, about why they felt that this mosque should not be constructed. And a lot of the commentary was, again, very much very Islamophobic. It was very xenophobic, sort of, you know, we don't want these people here. They're going to create a jihadist camp in our community. They should not be welcomed. So that anti-immigrant language. And then also there was some collaboration that occurred with members and spokespersons of sort of the industry of Islamophobia, which is this cottage industry. And the Center for American Progress has done a great report on how a small group of organizations and spokespersons over the last 10 years have really been able to build the funding necessary to create and foment a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment in different parts of the nation. And that particular group of people decided that Murfreesboro would be a breeding place to foment that sort of fear. So all of that came together. And in addition, conservative Tea Party members in the state legislature started to pass bills and introduce legislation that were also anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant. So that particular chapter in the book talks about how we really can't underestimate what happens when, you know, a lot of kind of conservative forces come together, anti-immigrant forces come together to push back against a small community that the only thing they were trying to do was to build a mosque so that they could go somewhere to pray and connect with their community.
Now, a lot of your book is about organizations and organizing itself. And the array of organizations representing South Asians and others is really rapidly changing. And also what they do is changing. So I wonder if you can tell us about some examples of the dynamic ways that organizations are representing South Asians and Arab, Muslim, and Sikh immigrants in the country. So who stands out to you as really doing some bold work here?
Yeah, and I think, again, there's been such a shift pre and post 9/11. So after 9/11, we have seen some changes in the landscape of organizations that serve and advocate on behalf of these communities. A few that I'll talk about very quickly. In the South Asian community, I think that we're seeing some groups, and I think we need more of these groups that are doing some organizing and base building, both in South Asian and Arab communities. So a group in New York City called DRUM, they see rising up and moving, organizes low-income or working-class, undocumented community members in order to advocate for change, such as the Community Safety Act, which is a piece of legislation that was passed in New York City. Another group is the Arab American Action Network in Chicago, which has been very active in terms of organizing in communities there and around the case of Rasmea Odeh, a Palestinian American activist who has faced some significant charges against her from by the U.S. government. And then there are organizations that are doing a lot of advocacy. So South Asian Americans Leading Together, where I used to work, does a lot of reporting, pulling together reports on xenophobic rhetoric, advocating on behalf of our communities in terms of racial profiling legislation. Muslim Advocates, the national network of Arab American organizations. So there are many of these groups. At Sikh Coalition, there are many of them that do stand out. And I think that they're doing service provision, but they're also doing advocacy that's very progressive. And they're also doing organizing and base building, which I think needs to be done more of. And I think the last piece I'll say is that I do think that there's a lot of alliance building that's beginning to happen with our organizations and with other communities of color, which I think is absolutely critical in terms of building the sort of solidarity that we need to say.
So tell us a little bit more about that piece of it. Because we're in the midst of a very long but still ongoing presidential campaign. But at the same time, there are these active social movements going on that are growing. So I wonder if you can talk about some of the cross-cutting issues that are tying the particular groups that you study in your book to some of the other what seem to be complementary social movements that are going on at the same time. And how are they working together? Are they working together in the context of this election campaign?
I'm not sure about the election campaign in particular. I think that will remain to be seen. I think that in generally speaking, there are two movements that I also reference in the book that I think are very complementary in terms of the organizing and the political power building that we see in Muslim Arab South Asian communities. And these are the Movement for Black Lives and the movement that's being led by undocumented youth. And I talk in the book about how both of these movements have been ways for our own communities to learn from and also to participate and engage in. So, for example, with the Movement for Black Lives, South Asian communities, Arab communities in particular, over the past year since Ferguson, have been talking about what it means to stand in solidarity. And that includes, for example, addressing anti-Black racism in our own communities. And it also includes making some of the linkages between the type of oppression that we see with police brutality targeting Black communities in particular, and the war on terror, which includes sort of the surveillance state. So how do we make some of those links between our causes so that we can create a more informed base that is working towards policy changes? So that's just one example. I do think from the election standpoint, thanks again to the Movement for Black Lives, I think the candidates are being pushed to actually speak on the issues that matter to our communities, that they need to be addressing issues such as profiling, police brutality, criminal justice, civil rights, that they need to be doing that in a more concerted manner and in a more prompt manner. So I do think that that's happening even now. You know, we're seeing some of the Democratic candidates who are expressing their concerns with the raids that are happening right now, focused on Central American children and families, right? So I do think that that sort of call to action is something that we can all be learning from in terms of how to push the candidates to be accountable to us.
The book is We Too Sing America, South Asian, Arab, Muslim, and Sikh Immigrants Shape Our Multiracial Future. The book is published by The New Press. And thank you so much, Deepa, for your time. I really enjoyed the book.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.